started out in the 70s, but the people you worked with, you know, had come out of the late 50s, early 60s generation. Morton Subotnick would be,
right,
you know, and James Tenney and so on.
Right.
How do you see that as far as how the technology has advanced and, you know, you're wanting a quad system in a stereo world?
Well, I guess, you know, it's funny, you know, when I was a student, actually it was when quad was like the big new marketing flavor of the, well, they hoped the flavor for all eternity, you know, CBS and Columbia records were coming out with quad and people were trying to sell quad stereo, hi-fi systems and so on, and it was a thing that never took off for many good reasons, but we were all working in a quadraphonic situation with Ampex four-channel tape recorders and things like that in the studios at CalArts. Technically, I don't think my system or my demands are so far outside of the mainstream. There's nothing really so exotic in what I use or what I ask my sponsors to give me, because it's the only thing that I care about is that it be of a certain standard in terms of quality, not necessarily technical capability, if you understand the distinction.
Mm-hmm.
It's a plain vanilla setup, but it should be made with real vanilla beans and not with artificial vanillin flavoring.
And yet your output is stereo. I mean, the sound equipment you're using.
I actually, you know, this is one of my dark little secrets, but usually I do work with stereo, but I play with the acoustics of the room in such a way, and I tend to surround the audience with sound, so people very often feel that it is quadraphonic. A lot of that is frankly just illusion, based on room acoustics, speaker acoustics, and just plain old psychoacoustics, that you get a feeling of dimensionality that you wouldn't have with plain stereo. But with most of my pieces, I'm trying to create a field around the listener as opposed to just a two-dimensional grid in the front, which is what you normally find in a stereo playback situation at a concert.
Mm-hmm. So how much in your performance then is working with that, the acoustics of the space?
Or the spatial location?
Yeah.
It's a compositional element. It's one of many. And, of course, it's a little harder to control because just the practicalities of the situation. Typically, I'm working in an acoustic situation that I've had not all that much time to figure out.
Mm-hmm.
In the kind of tours that I do, I'm typically arriving sometime in the day, same day as the concert, and working with an acoustical space that I may be unfamiliar with you know, each with its own different set of problems and graces as well. So I have to kind of use that, but it's not something that's under my complete control, unlike some of the other elements in my music.
Right. Well, also a sound system, too. It's almost like being a pianist coming in, even if you know the brand name you're getting.
Yeah. Yeah, if you know the brand name, of course, you're that much farther ahead, but even in that case, there are a lot of variables. But, no, it's definitely a crapshoot, and it's something I'd love to be able to minimize. I, you know, would like to get to the point where I could simply either tour with my own system or have, you know, one of these great speaker companies like Meyer or Apogee just supply a system everywhere I go. I'm not quite there yet, so I'm often forced to take what I can, and as long as it meets a certain standard, that's what I have to do.
Mm-hmm. On the subject of changing technology, I remember a performance that you gave during a contemporary music festival at CalArts, where you were doing digital sampling, but you had a custom-made piece of equipment, and it seemed quite elaborate, and you even took it the cover off and showed people that the person who had built it was somewhat paranoid to the point where they had scratched off all the numbers on the chips.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's actually not a custom-built piece of gear. That was, but it, almost. It was made by a small French company called Publisson. Sort of very high quality digital gear. This was in the early 80s, and there weren't so many of these devices around. The manufacturer was paranoid enough that he, I think what he did is he sort of epoxied over, maybe he scratched it off, I don't remember, the critical numbers for some of the parts so that you couldn't get in and kind of reverse engineer the machine and build your own.
Mm-hmm.
It created a lot of problems when the machine broke down, which it often did, because there was just like, you know, one or two people around in the area who knew how to fix it. And it was a very small company with a very small market, so small, in fact, that one day I dropped by the field office in Hollywood and just to say hello to the sales rep. And he was there, and I looked on the wall above his desk, and there it said, Publisson, Peter Gabriel, Stevie Wonder, Craig Hunley, Carl Stone, and a couple other names, so I knew that I had finally arrived in the elite. So that just shows how small their customer base was, that I would actually find a place in rather large letters on their wall right up there with Peter Gabriel.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Of course, now the technology you use is pretty standard as far as availability and so on.
Yes. It's all not particularly esoteric stuff. It was actually after that device, the Publisson, was stolen from me in 1985, that I decided to sort of change my whole approach. I had my insurance check in hand, and with one of those boxes, I could buy an entire MIDI setup, including a computer, a sampler, a Yamaha 128 voice synthesizer, and a bunch of other goodies as well. So I felt that it was good to sort of plow that money into something new. And by switching over to a computer-based system and using MIDI for all of its faults, I did gain a lot of what I was seeking in terms of programmability and very precise control over time, which I didn't have in using my Publisson.
But it really didn't change your compositional approach, did it?
Well, a lot of my basic concerns remained the same, but I think it did change my approach. The mechanics of working were completely different,
mm-hmm.
and I think it did sort of change the vocabulary of the music to a certain extent. But I was still, fundamentally interested in time, interested in the use of appropriated music as a starting point, and so those things, carried over from that one era to the other.
Mm-hmm. Are there any works which would particularly demonstrate that, or
from which era?
Well, from the shift from using the Publisson to more standard digital and MIDI techniques.
Well, the pieces that appear on my first CD, the one called Four Pieces,
mm-hmm.
Really come from that area. They're sort of the first generation of Macintosh-based pieces that I composed. Pieces like Shinki, which is based on a sample of Akiko Yano, the Japanese singer, singing Schubert Lieder, and Hopkan, which is based on pictures at an exhibition.
Uh-huh.
Plus, a couple pieces that aren't really based on samples, but are sort of demonstrating my concerns about, using a computer as an instrument as well as a tool in a live performance situation.
So the Publisson era pieces actually are not documented on CD?
They're not on CD, mostly because of copyright problems, frankly. The samples are so exposed, and I was using, in that period, I wasn't really thinking about any commercial releases, and so this is 1982, using a lot of Motown and things like that, so you see Michael Jackson and the Temptations and stuff, it's all over the place, and I just, it would be a nightmare to try and license it, so but those pieces will never see commercial release on CD.
I guess your latest CD that's come out is Nyala?
Nyala, right.
Nyala, okay. And that was originally to a piece of a collaboration with the dancer. You have to pronounce this for me.
Kusanuki Kuniko is the name of the choreographer.
Okay. And, I mean, this is something that on ArtsWire you had talked about, so we knew about this when this was happening.
Yeah, right.
But it's a beautiful piece. And,
thank you.
Sorry, if you could describe a little bit about it.
Well, it's... I guess to map it out formally, it's in basically four sections.
Mm-hmm.
The work is all derived from sample sounds. There's not one scintilla of synthesis in it. And it's actually all performed in real time using my little PV sampler. And the sound sources range from field recordings made in Borneo, of all places, the rainforest in Borneo, which is the very first sound that you hear, slowed way down, both in pitch and in time, so that it takes a very otherworldly quality. It's been compared in the press to the sound of whales and things like that, but it's all actually just the sound of insects and birds in the Borneo rainforest. This transmogrifies through sleight of hand into a kind of atmospheric choir of guitars, and that sort of builds to a climax at the end of the first section, which moves into a very percussive section. And then it goes into the most extended section of the piece, which is really where the dancer shone, and which uses this kind of time. It's neither expansion or compression, but some just kind of time manipulation techniques that I had been working on, where you're sort of moving the clock backwards and forwards using this music as a kind of marker. And for me, it's at once static and in a kind of perpetual motion all at the same time.
Hmm.
And that leads into the fourth and final section, which actually didn't exist in the original live performance version because at that point, the dancer pretty much run out of gas. But once the CD was coming out, I could sort of deal with the form abstractly without having to worry about dancers' stamina.
Right. Without that last section, it's about 40 minutes, a little over 40 minutes.
Yeah.
Yes.
That was about all she had in her.
How closely did you work with her in creating the sound, or was this a situation where you worked separately? And
we worked separately, back and forth. I sort of proposed different sound ideas to her, sort of static, just kind of sonographs, and she would react to them and you know, tell me which she found to be of interest. And then it was kind of then when I had sort of a sonic vocabulary, it was my task as a composer to sort of put it together into you know, shape it into a piece. And I did that and sort of sent that to her as a kind of second level proposal. And then I went to Japan and we met up and then we made some more kind of modifications in terms of the shape of the piece and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And then that was it.
Uh-huh.
She was pretty easy to work with in that regard.
Yeah, but it sounds like a good collaboration, though.
Yeah, it was a nice way to work.
Uh-huh. So there was no story behind this?
No overt story, that's true. I think that there may be some kind of scenario in her mind, and maybe in mine, too, but it's really not explicit enough to be able to state in words. It's more just kind of in the music and in the dance itself.
Mm-hmm. Would it be the same scenario for both of you?
Probably not. But that's okay too.
Oh no, that's great. Mm. It's interesting, this idea of creating music for dance, especially nowadays when it's so easy for a dancer to just pick and choose from recorded music.
Yeah.
Either asking for permission or not asking for permission. But it seems the whole art of collaboration between composer and choreographer is being lost.